John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and special gratitude for listening to my gravelly voice this hour, but you are going to want to stay with us.
Shut it down.
Sounds of protests in cities around the country. More than 200 arrests in New York City in nonviolent protests over no indictment in the Eric Garner case. Echoes of Ferguson still on the minds of protesters. In Cleveland, authorities are investigating an officer seen on tape shooting a 12-year-old black boy who was holding a toy gun. African-American men and boys dead at the hands of law enforcement. A nation wonders, where is the accountability? What is justice? And what is the future?
I have a biracial son who looks black into society, and he's 12. And I find it very hard because you know that you are essentially saying to your child, you can't be innocent anymore.
She's an academic and a mom. Renee Romano is author of Racial Reckoning and professor of history at Oberlin College. Listen now to Gregory Carr. He's a college professor in St. Louis. But he's seen his academic credentials instantly fall away and desert him when he has encountered police in his own neighborhood.
I'm a college professor. I live in a very nice neighborhood, and my kids go to private schools. However, I had some family members, some cousins, come from Los Angeles. One of my cousins got a little warm in the house, being from California, and decided to go downstairs and open up the window. It set off my alarm, and so I turned on the porch light, and there was the St. Louis County Police. And so I opened the door to simply tell them, officer, that this has been, you know, this was a false alarm. They pulled their guns on me.
Now listen to Nicholas Casal, former detective first grade of the NYPD, who has had a whirlwind of thoughts and feelings since the Eric Garner grand jury decision.
When we start questioning the police officer like that, the police officer must be one of three things. He must treat everybody fairly, blindly, and infirmly, because that is the role of the police officer.
With the voices of protesters around the nation echoing in our minds, we brought these three people together in our studios to begin this hour with some tough talk about a hard subject. Stay with us and see if we got anywhere on an issue that has gripped the nation. We start with Nick Casal again from the NYPD.
I think that we look upon the police officer and we put so many burdens upon him. Police officers are not social workers. They're not going to go out there and remediate the ills of society. That is specifically the responsibility of elected officials in the legislature.
Let me make it simple then. What should cops do to change? They don't have to change everything. What do cops have to do to change?
Well, cops have a few things that we could look at to change, but just because we want to change one side of the equation, let us not discount the fact that those people who are encountered by police officers should have a degree of responsibility.
All right, well, we'll get to that. Why don't you think about what cops should do to change? Greg Carr, what do you think is the change here, is the bridge here, is the fix here?
I believe the fix is reform. In our situation in Ferguson, because I am 3 miles from Ferguson, I live in Normandy, and in a city that's 67% African-American, you have three police officers that are African-American, and so you have this presumption of someone in your community that doesn't understand your community, doesn't understand your cultural sensibilities, and suddenly when someone who is not from that community comes into that community and brings their own cultural baggage with them, there's going to be conflict. So I think education is the key and dialogue. Now, last time we talked, I coined the phrase courageous conversations. Now I think I would like to upgrade it with difficult dialogue. And we start having difficult dialogue about race. And one of the things that I'm doing in one of my classes that I'm teaching is their final paper is over Langston Hughes' poem, I Too Sing America. And when I gave that assignment the other night for our last paper, I would say part of my – it's about a 50-50 divide in my room between black and white, I could tell that some of my white students got a little tense when we started getting into it. And some of my African-American students felt very empowered, like, yes, we want to talk about this. So that's why I say education. And when I say education, it means one-on-one conversation.
All right, let's do it. Greg, you and Nick, you're nominated right now. I want you to have that conversation right now.
I agree with you, Greg. I mean, what we should do is to address the issue of disproportionate members of the Ferguson Police Department that do not represent the community. I am always a strong proponent that the police officer should come as when I became a police officer. I lived in the city. I'm born and raised in New York City. And when I was appointed a police officer, I had come from the city. So I understood the needs of the city. So if we want to bring police officers into the fold, we should give extra credit to local recruitment. We have a lot of quality people coming out of the military. We should give them some extra credits to join the ranks of the police department. We should not only stress education upon coming on the police department, but police departments do not have continued education as you go through your career. But remember this, with all of this comes something else. We need pay and benefits to support the requirements that we're going to impose upon the police officers. So I agree. Regional, local policing, elected officials, civilian complaint review boards, and equal pay and benefits will give you a higher quality of police officer. And I think that that's all we could ask for.
Greg.
And if I can coattail on that, there needs to be that cooperation between the police department and the community, not during a tragedy or a crisis, but when times are good. It seems like the only time we ever want to have these discussions is what we're talking about today with the Eric Garner case and Michael Brown case and the young man in Ohio. So we need to have these sorts of conversations when things aren't as tense.
Renee, would the test of that educational process, and I want to hear your fix as well, is the test of this educational process working, that the next video, like the Eric Garner video, everyone will agree that something fundamentally wrong happened there and there won't be this grand jury outlier in the middle of the process? Is that the test?
Well, I think that's an important step, that we get more consensus in this country, or more recognition, not even consensus, more recognition that there are real problems, that it's not just aberrations, that there's something fundamentally going wrong here. And until you get that kind of willingness to concede that there's a problem, it's going to be hard to move together towards collective solutions. And I think education dialogue, absolutely vitally important. I also think accountability is vitally important. One of the things we've seen in each of these cases that where the grand jury does not indict is essentially a statement that these killings are not murder, right? It is us as a society, as grand jury reflecting the American society, saying we do not consider this murder. Murder is only murder in a society that considers it so. It is something we define.
But that's part of the education.
Accountable.
That's part of the education because grand juries don't reflect American society.
Except there are steps that one of the things that can happen and that is starting to happen is the Justice Department coming in, the U.S. Justice Department, and saying this decision is problematic. In Cleveland, where I live, they just came out with a report yesterday saying the Cleveland Police Department has an endemic use of excessive force. There can be outside figures who hold or institutions who hold people accountable. And this is a case where we need to hold police accountable for the way they're acting. But I also think, and I am sympathetic to one of the things that Nick is saying, that it's not just police. If we reduce this only to police are the only ones responsible for change, that's, to me, it's a larger issue. We need to ask ourselves hard questions about the world we live in. When, you know, the Tamir Rice case, where you see a 12-year-old black boy being shot after given 2 seconds of warning, which is not enough time to even, it's astonishing to me, and it's horrific to me, that would be the response, that this little 12-year-old boy is such a threat, we need to shoot him within 2 seconds of arriving on the scene. But to me, that shows an underlying problem of racial bias that are endemic in American society.
If I said right now to the three of you, and you were in this studio, you know, let's just go and join this crowd in the street protesting. I don't know what we'd say. I don't know what sign we would hold, but let's just go be a part of it. Nick, would you come along?
No, I wouldn't, because I think that we have to accept what has happened. I mean, Mamadi said to accept the truth no matter where it comes from, and I don't think that it is the responsibility of protesters, looters, pundits, and politicians.
Protest is not looting.
No, I put all four of them together. I don't think that we should have to hear the cries of the crowd when the judicial process, they believe, has failed. I think if you believe that a police officer is a second-class citizen, that just because the grand jury in two of these cases has come out and voted a no-true bill, that we're not satisfied with that.
But isn't that what the police are protecting, the laws of the Constitution that make it okay to protest?
Yes, the first day on the police department, you defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States. That's your oath.
But you wouldn't join the protest?
I would not join the protest because the protest, the purpose of the protest, as I see it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is to change the lawful decisions of two grand juries.
Let's get Greg's view. Would you join the protest, Greg?
Given the chance, yes, because without protest, there would never have been a Boston Tea Party, because the Boston massacre that we know it was also known as the Boston Riot. And ironically, an unarmed young black man was shot. Looting and rioting happened, and we got an American. I'm not saying that's what we need to do, but what I am saying is protesting is a part of the fabric of America. It is a part of the Constitution. We have the right to assemble and protest. Without protest, we would not have had the Civil Rights Movement. We would have not had the women's suffrage movement. So we would not have had abolition of slavery. So protest is a part of American society, and without it, we would not be the democracy that we are today. So, yes, I would join them, and in spirit, I am a part of them, because many of those young protesters are and have been some of my students, and they're traveling across Missouri to make their voices heard even at this moment as we speak, and I'm proud of them.
Renee?
I would absolutely join the protests, because I think we as Americans all have a responsibility to help the society that we hope to see come into being. And as I see it, these protests are about not necessarily reversing two grand jury decisions. I think that's past. It's about making sure future decisions are different, but also about asserting what I would have on my sign is Black Lives Matter, that everyone's life matters equally, that I don't want anyone's son to carry the burden of not being allowed to be a child, of having to face extra fear in their own home. No one should have to carry that burden.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for thinking hard about some hard subjects and thinking clearly, or as clear as we can on this day, about the way forward. Nicholas Casal, Gregory Carr, and Renee Romano, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, of course, this is your discussion, your forum as well.
My name's Greg O'Driscoll. I'm calling from Waycross, Georgia. There's something seriously amiss with the power structure in this country. We want to believe that the system works, because if none of us believe the system works, then what are we fighting for? What are we voting for? What are we trying to protect?
My name is Jennifer Adams. I'm calling from Vernal, Utah, and I admire the people who are keeping their emotions under control, because I am a white, middle-aged female, and I am absolutely livid. I just want to scream at somebody. I'm ashamed to be white, frankly.
Vent, explain, plead, argue. Help us all get somewhere on this. Call 8778-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the takeaway. When Ebola jumped from the remote wilderness of West Africa to population centers, the Liberian capital city of Monrovia found itself at the center of a crisis. The region has had more than 6,000 cases, 50 new every day. How does critical information get to the people who need it in an epidemic of this magnitude, with a disease this deadly? Brooke Gladstone, host of On the Media, went to Monrovia to see firsthand as the journalists at Front Page Africa try to fight ignorance with modern medicine and hysteria with hard facts. As she discovered, it's a battle between the messages of journalism and the messages of the government.
The media have actually felt quite a bit on the sidelines. There was an effort earlier by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to suspend certain articles of the Constitution, including those that relate to free speech. She was voted down by her bicameral legislature, but it was a real warning shot to the media. And there have been, over the last few months, several efforts to close people down, to intimidate them. They say that the media, if they don't stick with the program, could be endangering public safety. Obviously, the media take a very different point of view.
And, you know, the issue of hysteria is not one that's confined to West Africa. We've had it here in the United States. Part of this entire story, though, is about information flow in terms of what will help stem the crisis, relief agencies get into the affected areas. What are you seeing?
Well, the information flow actually at this point is not too bad, John. I mean, everybody seems to understand what safety measures are necessary. Everywhere you go, well, I won't say everywhere, everywhere in the city of Monrovia, there's a bucket of water with a spigot full of, you know, it's basically chlorinated water that you rub your hands. And then if you go into a public building, they take your temperature. It's so routine. It feels as normal as flashing an ID. Now, when you get outside the city, you have roads, some of which are just impassable. We went to a hot spot where there had been a recent flare up where, it literally takes 2 days sometimes first to find an ambulance and then to get it through. It's mostly just four-wheel drive vehicles and motorbikes that can make it. So there are really different Liberias we're talking about here. Some are well in hand and some are still very much endangered. And the CDC just said the other day in a press conference that they're finding 50 new cases a day. Now, that's way down from over 150 a day, but it used to be all pretty much focused in just a couple of counties. Now they can be found in nearly every county.
We've heard so much about the lack of medical infrastructure in West Africa. Monrovia is a large city with a concentrated population. Yet we're also seeing, and it sounds like what you have observed, is the creation of a parallel infrastructure to try to hold things together that includes those chlorinated buckets. What are people creating to fill the void of the medical infrastructure that we're told is non-existent in so many places?
Right. Actually, though, those buckets that we're talking about are considered part of the infrastructure now, not a replacement for. These are part of best practices now in Monrovia and every other place in the entire country. Now, the medical infrastructure is truly horrible, but as the information minister claimed, it used to be before the president came into office, this particular president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, that 7 out of 10 Liberians had no access to medical support within an hour's walk. And now it's a third of Liberians that have no access to health between health services within an hour's walk. So I guess that's a big improvement. I mean, in this country, if we said a third of Americans couldn't find any access to health, you know, within a short space, it would be pretty shocking.
As we've observed in places around the world, there's always a kind of life goes on story that's happening, even though we're talking about a place that's in a crisis. How are people just basically getting from day to day?
You know, the big fear that I've read in the papers, including the paper that we've been shadowing this week, arguably the best paper in Liberia called Front Page Africa, the biggest fear is that of complacency. All of this has become kind of the new normal. But then on the street, you see people, maybe 3 people on a single motorbike, sleeveless people. We were in an open debate forum where there were literally hundreds of people crammed into a really tiny space, as they observed themselves, sweating profusely over each other so that they could discuss whether or not it was a good idea to put off the election because of the possible exposure to Ebola standing in an election line. So you can see there's a certain amount of cognitive dissonance that's going on.
Is the international aid effort seen as a rescue operation? Is it seen as neocolonialism? How is that being viewed by the people in Monrovia?
The people in Monrovia, the ones that I've met on the street, the ones I've met in the hotels, they always say thank you. They're very grateful, but the government feels very differently about the aid programs. They have, the Liberian government, the president herself, has complained of what seems to be a kind of neo-colonialism. Meanwhile, the aid agencies, cognizant of the missing millions, have begun to set up their own parallel structures to serve the people outside the government. And that, of course, is a source of no little consternation within her administration. So there's growing tension there. But that is that's in the political arena, not so much on the street. On the street, it's just a question of why can't there be more ambulances? Why can't, you know, these hospitals deal with this situation? And of course, you know, the Médecins Sans Frontières group, the Doctors Without Borders, have been doing a wonderful job from the beginning, but there are local clinics who have been working as well, and there isn't a lot of sharing of information among those various medical outfits.
Some of the saddest photographs I've ever seen have come out of this crisis. How are those images coming to life in the stories you're being told about the fatalities and the inability to help so many people?
The pictures that we see in real life are the ones that are out in the countryside. I haven't even posted them, of just orphans. You know, there are huge numbers of orphans. There are just lots and lots of children. There are others who are quarantined to the extent that they don't have free access to food, and people just sort of leave it out in front of their house, and then they, you know, run away, understandably so. So, and then you see houses made of mud, mat walls, no electricity, no running water, no toilets, but Ebola attacks them vigorously if they aren't hooked up with the information system and if they don't understand what they need to do. So that sort of dissemination of information is still going on. It's getting out there. It isn't entirely out there. And as I said, there are still 50 cases a day.
Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media, reporting from Monrovia, Liberia.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The nomination of a new Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, has emboldened senators to take another pass at passing the Military Justice Improvement Bill, which would strip military commanders of the authority to decide whether to prosecute a sexual assault case. As the law stands today, if a member of the military is sexually assaulted, they have to report it up the chain of command, and commanders can veto sanctions and punishments in some cases. Earlier this year, the bill fell 5 votes short of passage, but after a Pentagon report released this week that military sex assaults are up 8% from last year, there's a renewed push to pass the bill. New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is leading the push for this overhaul. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
Now, you've spent a lot of time talking with Senator Gillibrand. Who's joining her on this? Does she have bipartisan support?
She has lots of allies like she had last year, but she never had enough votes to get her reforms passed. That doesn't mean Congress didn't do anything, John. There was a big package of reforms that were passed last year, just not Senator Gillibrand's reforms. As you mentioned, reports of sexual assaults are still within the chain of command, but retaliation is now a crime. It took authority away from commanders to overturn a verdict by a judge. There were some other reforms, too. And one of the things that this report showed, we have to say there were some signs of major progress. Reports of sexual assaults were up. The Pentagon said that's a good thing. That means more victims are reporting. But also, there was a report that 1 in 4 victims chose to report their claims this year. 2 years ago, that number was only 1 in 10. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said a lot more victims are reporting. That's good. Claire McCaskill, who was the sponsor of the package of reforms that did pass, spoke to reporters yesterday, John. She said one of the big takeaways of this report for her is that many, many more victims said they liked the treatment they got from their commanders. They liked the treatment they got from sexual assault counselors and advocates, given the tragedy and the difficulty they had been through. Listen to McCaskill.
High levels of satisfaction with command climate, high levels of satisfaction with their special victims councils and their victim advocates. And I think 73% of them saying they would recommend that others report is a very important number. If you are undergoing retaliation that is debilitating, the last thing in the world you're going to do is recommend somebody else come forward.
Now, is she taking credit for progress or saying we need to push forward with Gillibrand's proposals?
She is taking credit for progress. She's saying there's more work to do. She is not saying push forward with Gillibrand's proposals. The two of them are divided on this, and the Senate is divided on this. But the last thing that McCaskill mentioned, she mentioned retaliation. This is the biggest deal for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand here. The report said that 62% of victims, mostly women in the military who reported sexual assault, also reported retaliation, mostly from their peers, but that they were retaliated against when they reported it. Listen to Gillibrand here.
In the report that was just issued today, 62% of people who have experienced sexual assault and rape were retaliated against because they reported that they were raped. That is unacceptable. That is not a measure of justice. That is a justice system none of us would ever accept for our sons or daughters. And we should not be making our military families accept such poor access to justice.
So what is her solution?
John, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is trying to revisit her reforms. Now, the key part of her reform, which a lot of the military did not want, which Claire McCaskill did not want, and many Republicans do not want, although not all, is to take reporting of sexual assaults out of the chain of command entirely. And she says that the reports on retaliation show the military has not made progress on the issue of retribution, either from peers or from commanders, when you report a sexual assault crime in the military. She says, take it out of the command structure entirely, report it outside of the chain of command so that a victim isn't going to a buddy or a friend or a colleague of the alleged perpetrator when they report a crime. You wouldn't do that anywhere else in society, but in the military. That's Gillibrand's argument. The question is, will she get it? The defense authorization bill is back up on the floor next week. Gillibrand is pushing for a vote. She probably won't get it because leaders don't want to open that vote up to amendments because it's the end of the year. They say there's just no time to open this bill up. We got to ram it on through. But to Gillibrand, this is a major failure. She said that the Pentagon made promises, the president made promises. I sat down in Senator Gillibrand's office with her yesterday to talk a little bit about this. Listen to what she said.
The military said, give us a year, give us a year. We'll show you we take this seriously. Well, the one measure about whether commanders take this seriously is whether they're allowing victims to be retaliated against for reporting. And for that number to not budge, for that number to be exactly where it was last year, shows complete failure.
And she says it shows that as long as it's in the chain of command, retaliation is natural, is almost permitted.
That's exactly right. Now, supporters of the reforms that were in place, like Claire McCaskill, say, yes, retaliation is a problem. We have to make progress on that. However, the vast majority of those retaliations were by peers, meaning colleagues who gave you a hard time for reporting, and not by commanders. Now, that doesn't make it right that peers retaliate. McCaskill and supporters of the current reforms say we got to crack down on that. However, because it's peer retaliation, it's not the kind of career-wrecking retaliation that comes from above if you report a sexual assault, although they do say progress still needs to be made. Now, I said that Gillibrand is probably not likely to get her vote next week. She says she wants a separate vote then on military sexual assaults, a new vote, just like when the Senate reformed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I spoke to Senate leaders, to their staffs. They say that's not likely to happen before the end of the new year. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, however, says, John, she's going to use the nomination of Ashton Carter that you mentioned at the top as defense secretary early next year to make this a platform. She could hold up that nomination. She said she's not sure, but she's definitely going to use it as a platform to shine a new spotlight on the issue.
We shall see. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
And more of your voices reacting to the grand jury decision not to indict the police officers in the Eric Garner shooting. From Daytona Beach, Florida, one of you writes, don't break the law, don't fight with cops, follow lawful commands, dress and conduct yourself in an educated, professional, and courteous fashion at all times.
My name is Rafael Campos. I'm calling from Augusta, Georgia. The only way that we are going to make a change is if we change the standard operating procedures of police themselves, or if we change the legal definitions and legal repercussions for their actions.
Here's one from Minneapolis. White Americans need to step it up. White Americans need to acknowledge their white privilege. Our experiences with the police have never been the same. Admit it. Call us if you want to admit it or vent or argue. 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
So the Bureau of Labor Statistics released the jobs report today, and we'll end on a happy note, I guess. The numbers are big. Employers added 321,000 jobs in November, the most in nearly 3 years. The unemployment rate remains at 5.8%, however. Wages seem to show an upward trend, though. Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for our co-producer, WNYC, is with us. Charlie, welcome. What
Hello.
Do you think?
These are really great numbers. I mean, they were way above expectations. And even if you look at the reactions of economists and other people who, you know, really pay attention to these numbers and come out with their morning reports or sort of quick analysis, you saw words like surprising, encouraging, blockbuster, strong report. So I think a lot of people were really happy to see these strong numbers. And in particular, that wage growth number, that's really important because wages have been so stagnant for so long. Even if this is just 1 month, and you always hear 1 month is not a trend, but this is 1 month where you saw a nice uptick in the wages that people were getting. And if that is consistent, if you see that going forward, that's a really good sign because people have not been earning as much as one would hope.
Now, if you pair the increased payrolls with the wages going up, does this mean businesses are getting more confident in the economy, they're hiring and raising wages, or are these two statistics independent of each other?
They're connected in the sense of companies are feeling that consumers are spending, that the economy is doing better, so they are hiring people and bringing them on to meet the demand. At the same time, maybe they're finding it difficult to find the people that they want, or you know that you always have this thing called slack in the labor
right,
force.
Right.
You know, the slack issue. If they're finding it more difficult to bring in more people, they have to start paying more money to bring people on board. And that is getting to the sense of, okay, if wages start going up, that's telling you that we're getting to the point where more people are coming into the workforce, hopefully. And so therefore, you have to start paying people more to keep them, to bring people on, to get them to change jobs, that sort of thing.
I got two things for you, Charlie. First of all, this is a long streak. What do you make of that?
The long streak of these jobs we're seeing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here's the thing. These jobs numbers are really good, but, you know, even if, as one person pointed out, even if we had these numbers pretty consistently, you know, say around 300,000, 250,000, it would still take us some time to get back to the pre-recession labor market that we had. At this rate, it would probably take almost 2 years to get there, according to one report. So you know, what we're having here, these are really good numbers, but we were in a really deep hole. And not only do we have to get more people hired, because while we may have more people working than we did immediately before the recession, we still have a lot more people who came into the workforce since 2008, and people's wages haven't really increased that much over the last decade. So you've got these two factors. We need more people employed, and people need to make more money.
Increases by thousands doesn't compensate for decreases in the millions, which is what the recession is.
But all right,
before
we
go,
this is a good report.
Good report. Yeah, no, we'll take it. Less than a minute, much less than a minute. Anything in here address the income inequality that we've been talking about all week?
I think this wages is the most significant part, that we're seeing a little bit of an increase there. But in terms of the larger issue of resolving income inequality in this country, this report doesn't have the answer for it and doesn't necessarily point the road out, the way out.
So don't look at the numbers for that. Charlie Herman, have a great weekend.
You too.
Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for Takeaway, co-producer WNYC. And from raw numbers, we return to some raw emotions about the nation we live in today. All week long, as I said, we've been addressing the widening economic inequality in America and around the world. What do these numbers feel like to someone who the U.S. economy left behind a long time ago? We spoke with Tim Wood, a husband and father and struggling editor of a weekly newspaper in Chatham, Massachusetts, who says he feels like he's on the outside of the U.S. economy looking in.
We've, sort of stayed steady state here, but we're not going forward. We're not going back. So these numbers, the impact on us seems pretty distant.
And how do you feel about this discussion of inequality we've been having all week, and the idea that you know, of all the bridges that need to be built in America, that one is perhaps the most challenging, the haves and have-nots.
I would agree with that. I think we see that a lot around where we live because it's a very upscale resort community, and there's a very big disconnect between some of the rather wealthy summer visitors or summer residents around here and the rest of us who live here year-round. We tend to be middle-class to lower-middle-class workers, and then we see a lot of houses that remain empty for 10 months out of the year, while the rest of us sort of struggle to pay our mortgages and heat the homes and put groceries on the table.
Who do your kids think the rich people are?
My kids see them as sort of the people in the big houses on the water who are making money off of other people's money, basically, not really being the productive people that they would hope to be.
Now, all these economists are crowing that this is, you know, fabulous news and really talks about the strength of the U.S. economy. Maybe this is the, you know, this is the peak here. This is as good as it's going to get, Tim.
It could be. You know, for us, if it percolates down to more people coming on vacation, that's great because that fuels our local economy. It means that there's more advertising for my newspaper, which means that my newspaper is going to stay open, unlike a lot of them. And it means that there'll be jobs for local folks in the shops and in construction.
But it certainly doesn't affect the inequality.
It doesn't affect the inequality. Our wages have sort of stagnated like a lot around a lot of people around the country, whereas our health insurance costs, for instance, have kept going up.
What do you say to people out there listening to, you know, these two guys talking on public radio? Will they stop whining, please? I mean, come on. Let's get the American spirit going here. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. What do you say to them?
That's a valid point of view, but I think it's unrealistic in this day and age because the opportunities to pull yourself up by the bootstraps just aren't there for most of us. Corporate jobs, the company jobs that used to be able to fuel that just aren't there. And I think that people are struggling and people are trying to do that. We're just not having the opportunity to do it.
Well, Tim, have a great weekend. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you, John.
Tim Wood is the editor of a weekly newspaper, married father of two kids. His wife works part-time. He's in Chatham, Massachusetts. Building bridges in America. That's sort of our theme this hour. From the rich to the poor to the rich, black and white. We've been talking about the decision not to indict the police officers involved in the Michael Brown and Eric Garner deaths. What's your reaction to all of that?
This is Randy Abrams calling from St. Louis, Missouri, regarding the Eric Garner case. I'm just disgusted. That's all I can say. That's all I can think of.
Hi, this is David from Charlotte. What has happened to our police department, law enforcement services, where deadly force is becoming more and more the norm as opposed to the exception? Why are these situations elevating? Why are police seemingly in the habit of responding violently to uncooperative people to the point of death?
It's David from Charlotte. Is that your impression? Here's someone from Gainesville, Georgia. I don't care what the circumstances. I think every cop who kills someone needs to go to trial, period. It's not a waste of tax dollars for citizens to feel confident. Our law enforcement and judicial systems work. If we need to overwork the systems to gain that confidence, then so be it.
People who think this is not a race issue are really missing the point. Yes, this didn't happen in a rich neighborhood, but how many black rich neighborhoods are there? And I'd also like to point out that if you really want to see what it's like to be black in America, maybe you should look at the Twitter feed for Living While Black right now. You really get some shocking stories there. Thank you.
We'd love to hear your stories. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.